This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What Dr. Lager asked me to do tonight is to review some of the issues in nutrition related to women's health. There aren't that many aspects of nutrition that are different for women's health than men's health. Although I will emphasize the differences as we encounter them. But what I really wanted to do is leave you with the promise that at the end of the evening, despite all the controversies related to nutrition, that there are simple answers out there that can be achieved by all of you and all of us as we choose our foods for ourselves and our families, and that a lot of the controversies related to nutrition are often made-up controversies, often related to those selling various books and products related to the controversy itself. It's going to be very much an evidence-based presentation. That is, by that I mean I'm going to look at the science, and by science in this case I mean mostly what we call randomized clinical trials when they're available, those situations where we look at a group who gets an intervention, a group who doesn't, and see who does better. Now, not everything in nutrition, of course, has been tested with randomized trials, so we're going to try to use some common sense and some clinical wisdom as well. But I have no conflicts of interest. I will say financial conflicts of interest. I've resisted all temptations to write a nutrition book or a diet book or endorse any products. But I have been at UCSF for a long time. The way I got interested in nutrition was I went to graduate school in nutrition before I came to medical school. It was a way for me in that era to take my science courses en route to sort of a pre-medical school equivalent, but I was fortunate enough to find some excellent teachers and mentors in nutrition both before I came to UCSF and when I got here. Early on in my time at UCSF, there was very little nutrition being taught in the medical school curriculum. We're talking now the mid-late 1970s. And as a group of students, we pointed out to the faculty and the deans that there were no nutrition leadership at UCSF. And we convinced them at that time that there needed to be one or some. And we ended up hiring a young woman who had just finished her degree in molecular biology and was moving to San Francisco. Her husband was also being recruited to UCSF, and that person turned out to be Marion Nessel. And so Marion and I had the pleasure of working together for about 15 years at UCSF, building the nutrition curriculum here, both when I was a medical student and later when I joined the faculty. Of course, Marion went on to NYU, where she formed one of the great nutrition departments, certainly urban nutrition and health policy departments at NYU, where she still is. Ironically, I'm proud to say my daughter is a graduate student in that department, so the circle may be unbroken. So tonight I'm going to talk about things that I know Marion agrees with, as well as many of our other local experts, and we'll go through those one by one. So why do we care about what we eat? There's no surprise here. If you look at the leading causes of death in the United States, as defined by the Centers for Disease Control, you can see that the ones in red are well known to be associated with diet and exercise. Some of the ones that are not yet in red may also well be. Certainly some of the ones not in red have nutritional implications after the fact. But we think in terms of a cause and effect relationship, the relationship between diet and exercise and heart disease, cancer, stroke, and diabetes are firmly established. And when you do some arithmetic related to that, it's been estimated that about a third of premature deaths in the United States can be attributable to poor nutrition and physical inactivity. Now, there's been some debates in the public health world between whether cigarettes or diet and exercise are worse than each other, which has more attributable deaths than the other. And like many of the controversies we'll talk about tonight, I think that's a foolish one. because clearly they're both essential to the public health, and both together lead to a large preponderance of preventable illness in the United States and increasingly around the world. As you know, most Americans do not meet the recommended exercise recommendations. We'll come back to that, but generally thought to be about 150 minutes of moderate exercise per week. And depending on what you define as healthy and whose guidelines you follow, only about 10% of Americans are said to have a healthy diet, or at least a diet fully consistent with nutrition recommendations. So what I'm going to do tonight is cover a wide variety of topics. Some of these will just be a couple of paragraphs, but others I'll spend a little bit more time on, trying to think about what's been new in the last couple of years related to each of these issues. So I'll talk about total calories and macronutrient issues. We'll just say a word or two about weight loss diets, dietary fiber, the new dietary guidelines and where they fit in with some of the older dietary guidelines, dietary sodium, vegetarian diets, Mediterranean diets, vitamin supplements, particularly antioxidants and B vitamins. We'll talk about fish oil. We'll talk about vitamin D and calcium. And then at the end, I'll summarize with some nutritional recommendations. Now, one of the things that's most dominant in any discussion about nutrition in the United States is the fact that we're in an epidemic of obesity. This is true in both adults and children, and of course it has led to the epidemic of diabetes. Most of this, in the 30 years that this has occurred, obviously our genetics have not changed. So the debate about whether some of this is genetic or some of this is environmental, I think it's pretty clear that the largest part of this is environmental. And the largest reason in our environment is the fact that there are more calories available to us, and we consume more of them than we used to. Now, fortunately, just in the last few years, this number appears to have leveled off. And in addition, it appears that the rate of obesity has also plateaued, both in adults and children. But that's on average. And of course, there are tremendous pockets of health disparities and in obesity in different parts of the population, particularly associated with minority communities and related to class and poverty, food insecurity, and issues like that. But the primary issue clearly is that we simply eat more than we used to, and as a result of that, we've gained weight. Now, if we look at what we're eating, and this is a little bit of a artificial slide because it comes from food consumption data, but if you look at the kind of foods that are accounting for calories in the U.S. diet, and again, this is average national data, you can see that foods related to added sugar and foods related to the consumption of white flour products dominate this list. Now, also on this list are fast foods and other factors. But if you focus on some of the ones right prominently at the top, desserts, breads, sugar-supplemented beverages, soda and energy drinks, you can see pasta and pasta dishes, and then more desserts at the bottom. You can see that if you focus mostly, as you think about nutrition, on excess sugar in the diet and excess foods coming from refined carbohydrates, which in general offer little nutritional value, then you're already making giant steps forward as far as improving both your own personal diet and the national diet. So one of the things I tell patients is that desserts should be celebratory. I know the French have a different feeling about that and eat dessert several times a day. Doesn't work in the United States, though, because we have no portion control during the rest of the meal. And so one easy way to begin to address these things is think about the place in the diet where are unnecessary desserts, soda pop for sure. Those of you have learned a lot about, we've all learned a lot about the role of supplemented sugar in the diet. And candies and so forth, and then a variety of other white flour type products. And we'll come back to several of those in a moment. Now, another key factor in our getting bigger has been where we eat. And again, these are average numbers. But if you compare the amount of calories that people typically eat at home compared to the amount of calories one might eat in a restaurant, and again, broad generalizations, you can see that both for people of normal weight and those who are overweight or obese, that pretty uniformly, unless you strategically try not to do this, the default is to eat more calories in a restaurant than one does at home. So another intervention, one that we use commonly with patients, is to help people figure out ways to consume more meals at home, to plan their meals, getting access to healthy foods at home, and so forth. Now, one of the big controversies, if you look at all the diet books that have been written since, at least since I remember, since the early 60s, they've almost all focused on some aspect of macronutrients. And typically, a lot of this has been, remember, there are only three macronutrients in the human diet, fat, carbohydrate, and protein. There's actually a fourth, which is alcohol. These are the four substances from which we burn calories. That's what macronutrient means in a clinical context. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether we should eat more fat, less protein, more carbs, less carb. And a lot, that's been very much the focus of many of the best-selling diet books over the last many decades. And there used to be debates. Some of you are old enough to remember the debates between Stillman and Atkins. And then Scarsdale showed up, and he was assassinated by his mistress. And there was a lot of back and forth about what was better as far as carbohydrate intake and protein intake and the like. And certainly more recently, a lot of the confusion about fat in the diet has all focused on simply these three elements. And typically, if you think about it, most of the discussions have not really argued that much about protein. So then it really just comes down to arguments about carbohydrate and fat. And so you can get very simple but correct in thinking about some of these complex subjects by focusing on the issues related to carbohydrates and fat, both of which we'll spend some time on. Now, if you look at the how the dietary guidelines have evolved over the last 30 years or so, the first ones since the reports in the 70s that recommended a low-fat intake, what you'll see is not just a change in the numbers, but an increase in the range of macronutrients that are now acceptable. So you'll see written no longer is that fat should be under 30% of calories, but rather you'll see a range of fat intake from anywhere from 30 to 45% of calories, and carbohydrate, big ranges as well, and even with protein, acceptable ranges. So we no longer try to pinpoint a specific amount of percent of calories coming from one of these three nutrients, but rather give people a lot of flexibility. Certainly in the context of weight loss, that is weight loss diets, and I'll show you this in the next slide, but also in the context of most other nutritional conversation, and this is now more personal opinion than really an issue for which there's strong science, but my personal clinical experience and feelings here is that in most clinical circumstances, total calories trump, you'll excuse the expression, trump the macronutrient composition. And what I mean by that is, if you're trying to lose weight or maintain your current weight, what matters more is what your total calorie intake is, rather than some of the subtleties of exactly how much carbs or exactly how much fat or exactly how much protein. We'll delve deeper into that as we go through this. But if you think about it this way, if a certain amount, if you're on a relatively a reasonable calorie intake based on your energy requirements, then even if your percent of one nutrient is a little bit higher than you think someone tells you it should be, the total number of grams of that is less because your total amount is less, if you follow. So as long as you keep the ceiling low, it doesn't matter so much how you balance the nutrients within that lower ceiling. And from a clinical standpoint, caring for patients not just with weight loss or weight maintenance, but also diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol disorders, and so on, achieving the desired calorie intake will improve almost all clinical circumstances. So we spend a lot of time thinking about diabetic diets around carbohydrates and so on as an example. But if you keep the calories down, good things happen. And that's true in almost all clinical examples that I can think about. Now, here's an example of one study, but there have now been 36 of these in the last maybe 15, 20 years. And this grows out of the debate that I've already referred to, that those who were selling diet books for years said, you know, if we restrict carbohydrate rather severely, which by definition means you have to eat more fat, right? It's because it's one or the other, or maybe a little extra protein because it's only one out of three, then you might lose more weight. And the people who were against that said, well, of course you lose more weight in the beginning because you lose more salt and water. You have more of a what we call a diuresis from eating carbohydrates. As you lose stored carbohydrate in the body, they're packaged with water, so that as you lose that weight first, you tend to lose water weight. And so it's been a debate for many, many years until, like I said, about at least the last decade. There have now been a large number of randomized trials that have tested this question, which is which macronutrient composition is best for weight loss? And so the way this particular study was designed, it was, from a nutrition point of view, a fairly large study. And they compared different amounts of fat, protein, and carbohydrates, the three major macronutrients, in different percents. And with this, the way this is written is this is 20% fat, 15% protein, 65% carb. And you can see it goes down manipulating both all three as you go through. And so in essence, you can analyze this as 15% protein versus 25% protein, 20% fat versus 40% fat, 35% carbs versus 65% carbs. So you can see rather large ranges of macronutrients here. And this was a weight loss diet experiment. So they taught people how to decrease their total calorie intake. And a couple of points were made, and the results of this study are identical with the other 36 of these. First of all, people lose about 7% of their body weight. This is a very consistent number. That most weight loss diets, people lose about 5 to 10% of their starting body weight. So if you expect to go on a diet and you weigh 200 pounds and you expect to lose 50 pounds, it's very unlikely that that's going to happen using traditional weight loss strategies. But 7%, which is a clinically important amount, it can help your blood sugar, it can change your lipids and so on, lower your blood pressure, is achievable. The main take-home point is that, in general, people didn't lose that much weight, so they were getting free care at a great health center, but only lost a relatively small amount of weight. The longer you follow people, the less weight people lost. And the people who stayed on the diet or continued this study for the full 2 years only lost 10 pounds, 4 kilograms. But a small number lost 10% of their body weight. That is to say, there's a Gaussian distribution of weight loss, and some people in the middle lose at 7%, but out of the tail, there are a few people who do very well. And that's seen in almost all weight loss studies. But the take-home point in this particular context is that the weight loss was correlated with adherence to the diet. That is to say, it didn't matter what diet you were assigned of these four different combinations. What mattered was that you followed the diet. And again, this has been shown in studies with brand names, so the Atkins diet versus the Ornish diet versus the Zone diet versus Weight Watchers, or any way you want to frame this conversation, the results are almost all the same, which is that adherence or in this case, attendance at the clinics and the group meetings and so forth, is what predicted success, not the assignment to a given diet type. So if you have a preference for a weight loss diet over some other weight loss diet, and as long as it's still predominantly composed of relatively healthy foods, and we'll define what we mean by that as we go through, then it doesn't really matter that much whether it's a low carb or a portion control or a vegetarian or vegan diet, that all of those can work for weight loss. And in fact, when you look at some of the metabolic parameters that we correlate with the abnormalities associated with obesity, there also was no difference in those parameters as a function of the macronutrient breakdown. So the take-home message here is that total calories trumps macronutrient breakdown. Okay, let me move on next to dietary fiber. This is also a macronutrient of sorts. It's a big molecule, but it's one from which calories are not derived. So dietary fiber is plant matter, which is not digested by human digestive enzymes. Some of it can be digested by gut bacteria. And of course, this is an area of tremendous interest now as we think about the microbiome and ways that changes in the microbiome may affect our health. And the products that you'll see on labels that include dietary fiber are shown here. But typically, this is the part of a food stuff, which is forms the bulk of the stool that is not digested throughout the human GI tract. You may hear about it as soluble or insoluble. That's important in some conditions, but both are useful in the conversation that we're about to have. A soluble fiber, because it dissolves in water and dissolves in the liquid environment of the gut, can also absorb with it things like sugars and fats. And so soluble fiber is a little bit better at lowering blood sugar in diabetics and a little bit better at changing lipids in people with a high blood cholesterol. But both soluble and insoluble fiber are beneficial for the gastrointestinal tract. So one would want a mix of soluble and insoluble fibers. And the recommendations for dietary fiber are shown here at the bottom, with 25 grams a day or so for women and 35 or so for men. And those numbers don't mean much to you except when I tell you that most of us eat about half that. One way to think about it, if you don't like the approach of focusing on extra sugars and extra white flour in the diet, another easy way to think about nutrition is think about foods which are high in dietary fiber. Because as a general rule, foods that are high in dietary fiber have not been refined and are less likely to have added sugars to them. So it's two sides of the same coin. And as I mentioned, here are some of the health benefits that have been reported from fairly good science related to dietary fiber. One might call it the most important nutrient, even though we get no nutrition from it. It lowers blood cholesterol, that's what LDL stands for, and triglycerides, another lipid fraction. It lowers blood sugar. It has a variety of good things to your gut, and there's some evidence that it makes you feel full and therefore may help with weight maintenance and weight loss. There was an interesting study, there have been many of these, but a relatively recent study showed that this is actually now 22 analysis of 22 different studies, that for every 7 grams of fiber, remember 25 is a nice number for women, but the difference, say, between 7, 14, and 21, and 28, that each of those categories is associated with a close to 10-point reduction in cardiovascular events, so stroke and heart attacks. So a fair amount of impact associated with a simple nutrient. And this is equivalent, the 7 grams of fiber is equivalent to one portion of whole grains and one portion of beans or nuts, or from 2 to 4 servings of fruits and vegetables. So you have to work pretty hard to get up to 25. And for men, you have to work really hard to get up to 30. And this is some examples of foods. Of course, you can Google many lists of this, and it's fun to look at them. Because what you can see is that even within categories we think of as healthy and relatively high in fiber, there are some differences. So, for example, if you look at fruits that I've grouped up here, you can see that most fruits are relatively high in dietary fiber. These are grams per serving. We'll talk about serving size in a moment, but the easiest way to think of a serving size is about what you can hold in your hand of many foodstuffs. So I'll be more precise than that in a moment, but that's not a bad way to think about it in terms of order of magnitude. And so you can see that as you're making choices, the difference between, say, grapes and raspberries is quite striking. But in general, fruit is relatively high in dietary fiber. Vegetables as well, although there are some differences among them. This is one case that is fruits and vegetables where serving sizes work to our advantage. When we get to carbohydrates, serving sizes work to our disadvantages because we underestimate them. But if you eat a fair amount of salad, for example, or fruit, for example, it may be more than just one serving size. So that's where the dietary fiber comes from. In terms of grains and carbohydrate-type foods, you can see the difference between white bread and wheat bread, or brown rice and white rice. And again, a portion size is about the amount of rice you can hold in a palm in your hand. And then, of course, breakfast cereals are where fiber has gotten a lot of its marketing oomph. And you can see that that is a good source of dietary fiber, but there are others that are popular that aren't. And so you can make simple choices here and really change your dietary fiber intake. Legumes are uniformly high in dietary fiber. And I remember one class Marion and I taught together where we did a diet record of the medical students and tried to keep track of what they were eating as a way to teach them about how to assess diet and nutrition and so forth. And some of the students were coming in with these really high fiber intakes, and we were really impressed. And we realized it's because they were eating a lot of burritos. And so if you eat a lot of beans, your dietary fiber intake can be quite high. On the other hand, if you eat pizza, that wouldn't be the case, as another student choice. Now, I wrote down here powdered psyllium. So psyllium is the active ingredient in products like Metamucil and other over-the-counter dietary fibers. And again, this is a level teaspoon. So again, if you need to increase your dietary fiber by 15 grams a day, say, to get up to that 25 or 35 gram a day number, you have to crank the dose a little bit so that it doesn't work just to sprinkle a little bit in. You actually, if you're relying on this rather than diet, you have to take a fair amount of it. Of course, you want to build up slowly and so on. All right, well, let me move next to more broader conversations, and I'm transitioning now a little bit into the conversation about the dietary guidelines. And it's been known for some time, mostly from what I would call nutritional anthropology, that is, if you look around the planet at developing cultures and look at those who have a healthy diet in retrospect and those that have an unhealthy diet through analysis, the healthy diets have three features. People eat a wide variety of foods. They don't just eat, say, a root vegetable as their primary nutritional source of calories. That would be an example of an unhealthy diet. The food itself is high in food quality, and they eat the right quantity. And so when you think about dietary guidelines going back to your school days, and whether it was the four food groups or the food pyramid or whatever era of nutrition education you grew up in, they were the idea of those tools and those dietary guidelines was to get people to think about eating a wide variety of foods. So that's why there were four food groups, so that you ate from a variety of foods. It also was a way to promote dairy products, of course, since it was funded by the dairy industry. But nonetheless, it began to address the issue of variety. But it didn't really say anything about the quality of the food. But as we got a little bit more into the food pyramid and some of the newer strategies, there was a little bit more attention to the quality of food, but it was lost in the messaging. And so you knew you were supposed to eat more carbohydrates than anything else, but it didn't really focus that much on the kind of carbohydrates, for example. And none of the guidelines really have focused on the right quantity. And as I've said in my my reading of the literature and my opinion, it's really quantity that is the necessary third leg of the stool, if you will, in order to make a healthy diet. So you can gain weight eating too much healthy food, and you can develop a variety of other nutritional problems with defects in any one of these categories. But this is what the guidelines are trying to get at. They're trying to balance quality and quantity from a variety of healthy foods. And so the guidelines in 2010 were really a step forward that tried to be a little bit more precise in recommendations for the U.S. Public. And so here are some of the key phrases from that. And these are still true in the 2015 guidelines, which we'll come to in a moment. I won't repeat them all, but it's the principles were first really articulated in 2010. Enjoy food, but eat less. So a focus now on quantity at the top of the list. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. Consume beans, whole grains, nuts, and seeds. Increase the intake of seafood and fat-free and low-fat milk and milk products. We'll discuss all of these issues. Drink water instead of sugary drinks. Compare sodium in foods and choose the lower, I think that's supposed to be value, and consume only moderate amounts of lean meat, poultry, and eggs. And they came out with a new graphic. So instead of the four food groups or the pyramid, MyPlate came out in 2010 and is still being used by dietitians and by the federal government for food and nutrition programs. It's not a bad tool. I'll show you some variations on this that may be better. But if you are looking for a place to start reading about nutrition, the MyPlate website and the dietary guidelines, which were just published in January, are really quite good places to start. And then the variety of references to which they point to can be quite useful as well. And I have many of them listed at the back of the slides, and I'll make all these available to you through Jane. Now, MyPlate, even though at first blush it's sort of bland, but actually if you drill down, they begin to make more strongly worded opinions. So for grains, it doesn't just say how much you should eat, but it says make half your grains a whole. And we'll define that more precisely in a moment. It says eat vegetables, but not just any vegetables, a wide variety of vegetables, including dark green vegetables, red and orange vegetables, and legumes, and so on. So not just starchy vegetables. A variety of fruits, and we talked about the dietary fiber value of fruit. Dairy we'll come to as well in the context mostly of vitamin D and calcium. And we'll say a few words about the difference between whole and low fat as we go through this. But the guidelines still talk about low fat dairy products, lower fat dairy products. And then protein foods, they begin to say think about vegetarian options. Make seafood the protein on your plate at least twice a week. That goes from some longstanding data that people who eat fish twice a week have less cardiovascular disease and keep meat and poultry portions small and lean. And we'll come back to this issue because the implicit issue here is saturated fat a problem or not? And we'll address that. And so we'll drill down on each of these a little bit. In the context of grains, the issue is what is whole? We've already talked about most of what I'm going to say about the vegetables and fruits, but we're going to talk a little bit about the extent to which vitamin pills can substitute for fruits and vegetables. We'll say a few more words about calcium and vitamin D and the role dairy products play there, and then we'll talk about not so much protein, although we will talk about vegetarian diets, but also the fats associated predominantly with high protein foods. And then also, so just so you don't miss it, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about physical activity today, but the recommendations remain 150 minutes per week of moderate exercise. That works out to 30 minutes a day most days of the week. What I tell my patients is that exercise is biblical, 6 days a week and 1 day of rest. And then they began to get to the issue of limiting fats and sugars, but the fat, sugars, and salt. But in the new guidelines, they really became even more precise about this. So the new guidelines are called the 2015 guidelines. They came out in January 2016, finally. They were open for public debate for quite some time. And they're very similar to the 2010 guidelines, with a couple of highlights shown here. One is that the restriction on dietary cholesterol has been removed. So as you know, it's been said for about 30, 40 years that if you're worried about the cholesterol in your blood, the way that you should reduce that is by avoiding dietary cholesterol. And of course, the major source in the American diet of dietary cholesterol is our eggs. Also high in organ meats, which we don't eat much of, and certain shellfish, which we also don't eat that much of quantitatively. So it mostly was an issue of were eggs on the good list or the bad list. And it turns out they're on the good list because they're inexpensive, they're high in protein, they're relatively low in calories and relatively low in fat. Well, what about this dietary cholesterol relationship? Well, it turns out that although some people, when you give them a whole ton of dietary cholesterol, their blood cholesterol goes up, on average, the effect is quite modest. And if you manipulate the fat intake of the diet while you're doing that experiment, it's even more modest. What I mean by that is if you take two groups of people and put one on a low-fat diet and one on a high-fat diet, by this I mean saturated fat, and then feed them both dietary cholesterol, the bad cholesterol goes up a lot more in the people eating the high saturated fat diet than the people eating the low saturated fat diet. So that is to say, you can mute the effects of dietary cholesterol by controlling calories and controlling dietary saturated fat. So although we used to say there were three dietary factors on a lipid-lowering diet, dietary cholesterol, saturated fat, and total calories, the current thinking is much more focused on restricting calories and restricting saturated fat. And I'll be more precise about that in a slide or two. They reiterate the issue about fruits and vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, seafood, nuts, and legumes, and a diet relatively low in red meat and processed meat, sugar-sweetened foods, and beverages and refined grains. So again, you know, everyone's sort of on the same page here, and this is a point I'll make at the end, but people disagree with some aspects of these recommendations, but at the end of the day, there's a central core that everyone agrees to. And so if you're selling a book about eating less meat, you'll focus on that. But at the end, and if you're selling a book about eating less sugar, you'll focus on that. But at the end of the day, you know, everyone is agreeing on these basic principles. No matter what feeling you have at the fringes of the diet, the core is a set of principles that everyone, I think, agrees on, although they don't talk about that because they're trying to sell the book. Now, these guidelines in 2015 were a little bit more precise quantitatively, and so they came out rather strongly and said not just eat less sugar, but they said make sure that it's less than 10% of calories. They reiterated that saturated fat should also be less than 10% of calories, and that dietary sodium should be limited to 2,300 milligrams a day. And I'll define each of these in more detail in just a moment. We already talked about half of all grain intake should come from whole grains. This was an interesting addition. Moderate alcohol is fine in most adults. And this is only slightly controversial. There are some diseases, particularly in women, particularly breast cancer, where there is an association of an increased risk with moderate alcohol use. And of course, there are diseases of alcohol, of alcohol excess disorders. But for those in general, moderate alcohol is associated with less cardiovascular disease and longer life expectancy. And the other thing you'll be happy to know is that coffee remains the Teflon nutrient or Teflon food stuff. People have tried to pin bad things on coffee for decades and nothing has stuck. So all the studies have shown that drinking coffee is just fine, even up to 5 cups per day. And of course, there are some studies that suggest that it's beneficial. I'm not willing to go that far, but for most people, it's okay. Now, that's not to say it can't upset your stomach, of course, diarrheal illnesses or anxiety or even irregular heartbeats in some people. But in general, as a population, coffee appears not to be associated with bad health. All right, now let's drill down a little bit more on some of these topics and get sort of practical. So the guidelines recommend 6 servings of carbohydrate foods. And most people eat 8, so this is that room to move of trying to reduce. So whether you believe in a true low-carbohydrate diet or not, what we can all agree on is a lower carbohydrate diet, right? So the debate on the fringe will be how low should it be? But the principle is that everyone needs to eat a little bit less because we eat too many calories and a lot of the excess calories are coming from grains. And in the United States, almost all the grains are refined. And the goal is to have at least half of them be whole. These are some of the portion sizes. And the humbling thing here is that they're really, really small. And so as you're beginning to calculate portion sizes and relate that to calorie intake, this becomes one of the central issues for people is trying to understand what a portion of food is. So again, it's largely what you can hold in your hand. So this is a portion of pasta. And although I think this is actually a whole baseball, it's meant to be a half of a baseball because that's actually the size of roughly a portion of carbohydrate. And here are some other examples, such as a small tortilla, a slice of bread, a 1 ounce muffin. So if you buy a muffin that's, you know, normal size, it's probably 12 servings. Now, what's very hard, even in San Francisco, I think, is to make sure that what you're eating are whole grains. And that's especially true with wheat products. I think with the other types of whole grains, some of which I've listed here, it's a little bit easier. But especially with wheat products, there are a lot of words that sound like they would be whole grains, like wheat or enriched wheat or, you know, 9-grain. Or there are a lot of words that sound like they might represent, and they're brown in color, and might represent whole wheat but aren't. And so what you're looking for in the label is the word whole, and you want this to be the first ingredient because then it's more than 50%. Ideally, it would be 100% whole grains, and that's what you're seeking. But certainly if it's over 50%, you're on your way. Now, if you want to be very quantitative about that, what you can do is look at on the label, you can look at the ratio of carbohydrates to dietary fiber. Because again, a whole grain, or at least a whole wheat kernel, has a fiber outer surface. The middle part, which is the what becomes the refined carbohydrate, and the core, which is the wheat germ, where a lot of the essential vitamins and minerals are. And so if you have a refined carbohydrate, the fiber has been eliminated for the most part, but the carbohydrates, the calories, are still there from the endosperm. And so you can create these kind of ratios if you're really being critical looking at bread products. But even if you go to a really good bakery, it's hard to figure out. And so this is a real puzzle, I think, for a sophisticated shopper. Here are some of the other forms of wheat that are typically whole. And then, of course, there are other grains that are almost uniformly whole. So it's less common that you'll find refined buckwheat, for example, or refined rye flour. So those more typically are whole grains. And quinoa, some of the buckwheat, some of these others. Sugar, I think, has been talked a lot about. The Mini Medical School was the site of Robert Lustig's first sugar lecture that went viral around the world. We're extremely proud of not only that fact, but all the work that UCSF has done on the sugar science and popularizing the need to eat less, particularly sugary beverages. But the next step is what other sugary foods can we identify and decrease in the diet. Many of you know UCSF has eliminated sugar beverages from all of our patient rooms, patient menus, and even our public cafeterias and eating places. And we're hopeful that other hospitals and universities and other corporate entities follow that lead. The average person in the United States consumes 30 teaspoons of sugar and sweeteners per day, and the goal is to get it down to about well less than a quarter of that. So the new dietary guidelines say 10% of calories, but most experts in the field would say less than 5% of calories. So if you're on a 2,000 calorie diet, that would be 10% would be 200 calories from sugar, and a gram of sugar is 4 calories, so that's 50 grams of sugar, and a teaspoon is about 4 or 5 grams. So you can sort of do the arithmetic that way and figure it out. But pretty much, if it tastes really sweet and it has sugar in it, then it's going to have a lot of sugar in it. So soda pop, of course, is the worst culprit. And a 20-ounce soda has double the recommended in one beverage. So this is emphasize that this is not just about high fructose corn syrup. So this is about natural sugars, cane and beet sugar, honey, and so forth, all have the same metabolic impact as each other. So these are pure calories, 4 calories per gram, without dietary fiber, without additional nutrients. So say a word about salt. This has been a little bit controversial. One of our excellent faculty, Kristen Bibbins-Domingo, wrote a paper a few years ago estimating that we could markedly reduce the incidence of heart disease. CHD stands for coronary heart disease, and stroke by numbers almost equivalent to the reduction we see from cigarettes if we reduce the amount of salt in the diet. This is mostly by lowering the nation's blood pressure by a little, which would then translate into a reduction in stroke. So for those of you who are mathematically minded, if you think about the salt intake as a Gaussian distribution, a bell-shaped curve, what we're doing in this conversation is sort of just moving the curve over a little bit, and that translates in these kind of models to prevention of a lot of heart disease and strokes. Now, for an individual patient, that may or may not have much impact for you, but from a public health intervention, it has tremendous impact. And this turns out to have a wide benefit and was shown to be cost-effective. And the English have taken this on and have already shown, much like the Mexicans took on added sugar, and have shown reductions in stroke and heart attacks as using this strategy. There's been a little bit of a controversy about what the magic number is. But before I get to that, let me just talk about an individual person's sodium diet. So like I said, for the population, we're moving the curve over just a little bit. But for an individual patient, this becomes another tool in the toolbox of someone with high blood pressure. So it doesn't work for everyone, only about a third of patients, particularly older people with high blood pressure and African Americans who handle sodium a little bit differently in the kidney. What's now considered a relatively reasonable reduction of sodium to about 2 grams a day lowers your blood pressure as much as common low doses of medication. So this is an important way to reduce the amount of medication that people need to take for high blood pressure. You can also use what's called the DASH diet. DASH stands for dietary approaches to stop hypertension. And this is basically the kind of dietary guidelines principles that we've already talked about in terms of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and high fiber. It too will lower your blood pressure. And the take-home point is that if you eat that kind of healthy diet and lower sodium at the same time, it can lower your blood pressure as much as a moderate dose of commonly used blood pressure medicines, about 10 or 15 millimeters of mercury. So this is an option for people, and it's not necessarily a way to prevent use of medication, because as you get older, people need more than one in many cases. But it is a way to delay the use of medications and to lower the dose of medications and therefore prevent side effects and the like. Now, as a public health issue, there's been some controversy about this. I already suggested that in 2015, we now say 2,300 per day. But in 2010, there was a controversy where they said, well, we'll restrict it even more for these populations defined here. But it turned out that was over half the population. And to get down to 1,500 milligrams a day is quite hard, since food is so common in our food supply, and I'll show you that in a moment. So we now pretty much achieve consensus that since we're at about 3,500 a day, this is our usual, the average current intake in the United States, that having an argument about whether to get to 23 or 15 is another example of an argument that is not worth having yet, because we have to get down to 23. So the current recommendation is now, everyone agrees, is more of a moderate decrease from 3,400 per day to 2,300. Now, most of you probably think when I'm talking about reducing sodium that I'm talking about using less salt at the table or less salt at the stove. And it turns out that that's not true, that virtually all of salt in the U.S. diet now comes from processed and prepared foods. So you can be pretty, if you eat a pretty natural food diet, you know, the kind of diet that Marion Nestle used to describe as eating around the edge of the supermarket, not getting anything in a bag or a box or a can from the middle of the supermarket, you can use some salt at the table in the stove if that improved your taste preferences. Because that has very little impact on the total sodium intake, which mostly comes from anything you buy in a bag, a box, or a can, or at a restaurant, unless it says low in salt, you can rest assured is high in salt. So very little is naturally occurring in the current diet. So don't focus too much on the salt shaker. If that's the way you've grown up cooking, then that's an acceptable food preference. Just be careful of the processed and restaurant foods. Now, it is true that more than sugar, the flavor of salt can be reprogrammed. So there are some good experiments where people who preferred salty foods were put in what's called a metabolic ward, and fed a diet that was lower in salt, which they didn't like because they preferred high salt going into the study. But at the end of 2 or 3 months of a low-salt diet, when they were then tested as to their food preferences, they had relearned and now preferred a lower-salt diet. So you can reprogram your taste preferences as regards to salt, as you can for sugar. But it's a little bit easier with salt. Now, here's the list of foods that are high in sodium in the United States. You can see from, as you look at the list, that's the same list, right? So it basically allows you to focus on, you don't have to really think about salt very much. As you think about the processed foods and packaged foods that are also the highest sources of calories in the U.S. diet, you will also be reducing sodium intake, preventing strokes and heart attacks as a population, and for an individual patient, possibly reducing blood pressures and blood pressure medication. So fascinating that it's in many cases almost all the same list. processed meats and so forth, cold cuts, make this list, whereas they didn't the other list. But otherwise, it's really quite similar. Even energy and sports drinks and desserts and so forth that you don't think of necessarily as salty foods. Okay, let me move next and talk about dietary fat. And just a little chemistry, or at least definitions, before we get started. Fat is a long molecule with carbons and nitrogen, and it has a different amounts of double bonds in the molecule. And depending on how many double bonds it has, it defines whether we call it saturated fat, which means no double bonds, monounsaturated fat, which means it has one double bond, or polyunsaturated fat, which means it has more than one double bond. So that's what those words mean. They're chemical names. And depending on how far into the molecule the first double bond is, that defines whether it's omega-3 or omega-6. How far is it away from the N-methyl end, for those of you who remember chemistry, of the fragment. And so omega-3 are the fatty acids shown in these foods shown here, fish and most nuts and flaxseed and soy. And omega-6 are more the traditional polyunsaturated oils such as safflower and corn oil and so forth. And then in nature, if you remember the chemistry in nature, when you have double bonds from some of these polyunsaturated fatty acids, they're in the cis configuration. Both of the carbons are on the same side. But when you have processed fat, it goes into the trans configuration. And that little difference, which allows a food processor to keep something that's liquid at room temperature, like an oil, make it solid at room temperature, like Crisco. That was the rationale for transhydrogenating fats. And unfortunately, it turned out that those were quite bad for our healths. They led to high lipid disorders and premature cardiovascular disease. And these are almost out of the diet. They're not quite. There's still some time-limited arrangements with some of the fast food companies. But I think at this point, everyone has agreed to get them out on a schedule. So I think by 2017 or so, they'll be pretty much out of the food supply. So this is a victory for nutrition and public health. And now we're left with the more natural fats. And debating continuing our debate as to which of these three is preferred, and in the case of the polyunsaturated, whether there's a difference between omega-3 and omega-6. So that's where the controversies lie. Now, you probably remember hearing a headline about a year or so ago, that said, saturated fats aren't as bad as we think. And that came from a series of studies that mostly published in the British literature that shown that these were not experiments, but they were population-based studies that showed that populations who ate higher amounts of saturated fat did not, as was initially thought to be true, have increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So since the whole fat hypothesis began in the 40s and 50s with some of these transnational studies that showed the opposite, that showed, in fact, higher fats was associated with higher cardiovascular disease, this threw into question a lot of that thinking about saturated fat in the diet. But when you drill down on this a little bit and look at some of the metabolic studies that have really experimented with this, including randomized trials, again, where people are put in one group or another and compared, otherwise the same as each other, that when you take someone who's eating saturated fat and replace it with unsaturated fat, your cholesterol goes in the correct direction. That is, your bad cholesterol goes down and your good cholesterol goes up. So that is to say, if you reduce saturated fat and replace it with, quote, good fat, that's healthy. On the other hand, if you replace saturated fat with carbohydrates, then it's not healthy. So it turns out the punchline here is that it's not so much that saturated fat per se is good or bad, but it matters what you're replacing it with in the diet. So you have three choices. You can eliminate saturated fat and just take that as an opportunity to reduce calories, because all fat is 9 calories per gram. Doesn't matter how many double bonds you have or where they are. They're all 9 calories per gram. It's the most calorie-intense food stuff. But so you can, number one, find saturated fat in the diet and eliminate it as a way to reduce calories. That's good. And lipids will improve with that. Secondly, you can replace saturated fat with other types of healthier fat. And we'll talk about that in a moment. That's sort of what underpins the Mediterranean diet to a certain extent. But if you replace saturated fat with carbohydrates, which is basically what we told people to do for the last 30 years, that's a problem. So that's where we got it wrong. Not that saturated fat wasn't bad. It is. It's either neutral to bad. But the replacing it with simple sugars and refined carbohydrates is where the problem came. So the current recommendations are to limit saturated fat, and the number is 10% of calories, which is a relatively low amount. But be careful with what replaces it. The oils you want to use are the ones shown here, either the polyunsaturated oils or the monounsaturated oils, such as olive oil and canola oil, should be your replacement strategy for animal fats or tropical oils. Now, people often say, well, is it okay to eat butter? I personally think it is. Again, as if you're staying within your guidelines, if your goal is 10% of saturated fat per day, that's 200 calories on a 2,000 calorie diet. That would be 200 calories from saturated fat, and that gives you plenty of room for some butter in your diet if that's where you want to put your money. Now, if you're eating ribeye steak, then you are now running out of space. You've already used your budget of saturated fat, and so that might not be a good combination. But there's nothing wrong with saturated fat in the moderate amounts that are now recommended. The tropical oils, very little role for these, I think. Most of you probably spend a lot of your cooking with olive oil and canola oil, and that makes sense. So the Mediterranean diet has been, based on the observation that people in the Mediterranean basin had better health outcomes than people who ate more animal products, and it was predominantly because their fats were different. So you see right in the middle here in this cartoon is olive oil, which is representing the, quote, healthy fat or the monounsaturated fat, with a lot less of the red meat or dairy, at least in high quantities, that we often eat in the United States. So cheese, of course, is on the Mediterranean diet, but in smaller amounts. Maybe this is the cheese. And the Harvard team has come up with this healthy plate as a modification of the one that the federal government has come out with to make the point that you don't need to have a lot of dairy. You don't need to drink as much dairy as the dietary guidelines recommend. We'll come back to this. But you should feature the inclusion of healthy oils and a little bit more emphasis on whole grains on the plate. And again, some fun detail around there. Now, there was a very nice randomized trial two years ago, that really, one of the first randomized trials that really tried to get at, does a Mediterranean diet actually improve cardiovascular outcome in a more scientific way? And this was a Spanish study, and it has some problems, but let me describe it. It was a large study, of men and women who were from who were Spanish. They were already eating a diet which, from an American perspective, we would already characterize as pretty Mediterranean. In other words, they already were having a fair amount of their olive oil and vegetables and tomato and onions and garlic and things like that. But what they did was they took these people eating a fairly, what we would consider a fairly healthy Spanish diet, and they said to half of them, cut back on fat. And the other half, they said, either take in extra olive oil or take in extra nuts. Now, this study was funded by people who make olive oil and nuts. In addition, they didn't really do much teaching for the people on the low-fat diet. So the low-fat diet sort of ended up still eating a moderately healthy Spanish diet. So what this really turned out to be was a study of supplemental olive oil and nuts versus not, because the diets in the end weren't all that different. But the take-home message was, at the end of the day, the people in both the olive oil group and the nut group did better. And they did better with less cardiovascular events. That means less strokes and less heart attacks. So this study has led to many, many publications since this original one. Most of these findings have stood up, but they haven't been widely reproduced. But nonetheless, I think you can, it's probably true that including olive oil in your diet isn't going to hurt you and may help you. And including some nuts in your diet isn't going to hurt you and may help you. So we don't have that many good experiments that demonstrate that one foodstuff is so convincingly better than another. So this study, until proven wrong, is out there and reaffirms what we thought was true, which is that nuts and legumes and monounsaturated fat-rich oils are healthy. And the only thing for people watching their calories is that nuts are high in calories. So again, this is a case where you want to be aware of your total calorie intake and spend some of your budget on nuts, but not overdo your budget. A few words about vegetarian diets. Now, if a patient comes in to see me and I say, tell me about your diet, and they say, I'm a vegetarian, I say to myself, I still don't know much about their diet. Because people use the word vegetarian to mean lots of different things. So I then have to ask a few more questions. So these are some of the terms that are that people use to call themselves vegetarian. So vegans, fruitarians, these are self-evident. Lacto-vegetarians include dairy products, dairy and eggs, fish and vegetables, chicken and vegetables. And there are even people who eat red meat, but don't do it that often, and call themselves vegetarians. Some of them use the term flexitarians, or some of the literature calls them semi-vegetarians. So first thing is, when someone says they're a vegetarian, you want to ask more. The second thing is, just because they're doing any one of these things on the list doesn't mean that they're meeting any of our other dietary guidelines, right? So you can be eating, lacto-ovo vegetarian and eat a pretty terrible diet. So just because you're eliminating one food stuff doesn't guarantee, like red meat, doesn't guarantee that your diet is healthy. You still have to follow the other principles that we've discussed. Having said all that, there's a wide literature that suggests that people who do follow vegetarian diets are often have better health outcomes. And a good chunk of this literature comes from the Seventh-day Adventists who have other religious beliefs and cultural beliefs that are also at times associated with better health outcomes, like not smoking much. But there have been a series of studies within the Seventh-day Adventist community where they compared Adventists to each other, which controlled for some of these other factors. So just looked at the dietary difference within the range of behaviors of people who are all Seventh-day Adventists and otherwise followed the principles of the culture. So this is not an experiment. This is what we call another observational or a population or a descriptive study, but a very large study. And they had a lot of deaths over the 6-year time. And what they did was they took a dietary history and broke them down into that categories I showed you on the last slide. So they compared the pure vegans with the pesco vegetarians, the lacto-ovos, and the semi-vegetarians to non-vegetarians. And the overall finding was that all of these together did better than the non-vegetarians. So no matter what kind of, within the context of the Seventh-day Adventist culture, the vegetarian diet had a substantially improved mortality. So this is death over a six-year follow-up than people who are eating meats. So this is pretty interesting. Again, it's an observational study. It's not an experiment. It's not a randomized trial. So we don't know if this is this could be confounded by other factors. But nonetheless, it was very elegantly done and consistent with some older studies that had showed the same thing. And what was interesting is that the lowest, the people who, so the overall vegetarian group did better than the meat-eating group, but the lowest, the best outcome was in the pure vegans, but also the pesco vegetarians. So that was interesting. So that if you follow Michael Pollan, for example, you might add a little fish to your diet and get away with most of the benefits of eating a diet which is mostly plants, and we'll come back to that. Vegans did really well, and there is no clinical circumstance, including childhood and pregnancy and any disease state, in which a vegan diet cannot be made to be a healthy diet. It may require a little bit extra tactical maneuvering, but one should never be counseled out of the idea of being a vegan if that's your preference. But there may be more flexible forms of vegetarianism or quasi-vegetarianism that some people can follow. So I personally don't call someone a vegetarian if they eat fish, but in this context, that's one of the healthy outcomes. Okay, let's move next to vitamins. So this is relatively old news, but I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Not so many years ago, the following observations were made from observational studies that people who ate diets high in antioxidants had better health outcomes. It made sense because aging is an oxidative phenomenon. Disease is an oxidative phenomenon. So it made sense to think if you could do something to block oxidation, it would be associated with longer lifespans and less disease. So there was a lot of fanfare around taking the antioxidants as vitamin supplements. And this mostly started with things like vitamin E, beta carotene, vitamin C, and others. And about several years ago now, there was what we call a summary analysis, a meta-analysis of all the studies that had looked at this. There was a ton of patients or subjects, ton of deaths to look at. And what they showed basically was, despite the fact that we thought this would work, we thought it should work, and we thought it was going to work, it didn't work. And so it's analogous to some of the early data about hormone replacement, for example, where we thought that estrogen would be associated with longer lifespans. And in fact, when you do the experiment, it didn't work out that way. Now, vitamin A, this is now all-cause mortality. That means death. Increase with vitamin A, increase with beta carotene, increase with vitamin E, and increase with vitamin C. This one wasn't statistically significant, but you can see what we call the point estimate, or the numbers the same as just fewer studies. So, and all of these other ones were highly statistically significant. Now, so the take-home message here is that taking vitamin supplements with antioxidants is harmful. And so this is something that I personally, as when I'm seeing patients, go out of my way to recommend against. We'll get to some other things where it's neutral because we don't. There's no benefit, but there's no harm. But here, in some patients, there's actual harm. So you should not, in my opinion, be taking more than a multivitamin level of any of the antioxidants. Now, folic acid was also something that we hoped would prevent heart disease and deaths. Again, there's some biochemical pathways that made us suggest that this should work, having to do with homocysteine in the blood, which can cause premature cardiovascular disease. Again, meta-analysis of a large number of cardiovascular endpoints and cancers, and the take-home message was that there was no benefit on death, events, or cancer. And so the take-home message here, again, we thought it should work, and in fact it did lower homocysteine levels, so the should part of it worked, but the ultimate impact or effect did not. Now, folic acid is not harmful. There's no reason to take it, but you're not going to hurt yourself the way you would with the antioxidants, or at least on average. Now, of course, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but folic acid is very important in women of reproductive age because it does prevent neural tube defects. So we do try to pay very close attention to nutrition and vitamins in women of reproductive age, since half of pregnancies are unplanned in the United States. So you want to make sure that the young women are taking adequate amounts of folic acid. Since we eat so much wheat flour in the United States, and most of it has been fortified with folic acid now for about, I think, about 20 years, there's been a substantial reduction in neural tube defects in the United States. So this is less of an issue, but one of the groups of people who probably should, especially if their diet is borderline, take a multivitamin with folic acid are women of reproductive age. Because again, neural tube defects occur early in pregnancy and half of pregnancies are unplanned. Okay, now let's come back to our fat algorithm here and taxonomy and look a little bit about fish oils, because that just to remind you where we are here. Because back about 20 years ago, there were some studies that suggested that people who took fish oil had less heart disease in the form of sudden death. And so that was very exciting, and it caught on. And since then, a lot of people take fish oil or other omega-3 fatty acid supplements. And again, looking at giant meta-analyses of a lot of different participants, there is no significant effect of omega-3 fats on mortality, cardiovascular events, or cancer. So these studies, again, are totally negative. No harm. So again, if you really want to take omega-3 fatty acids, you know, I'm okay with that because there's no obvious harm. But there's no benefit from a very large series of experiments. And since this meta-analysis, there have been two other big studies. You can see quite large numbers, very well-done, state-of-the-art randomized trials, and again, negative. So pretty convincing evidence that omega-3 fatty acids don't confer the benefits that we hoped that it would. All right, towards the home stretch here, let me say a word or two about vitamin D and calcium. So many doctors and other clinicians have gotten into the habit of measuring vitamin D levels. And there have been a lot of studies, again, these sort of observational studies, which are what I would call hypothesis generating. You know, they give us good questions to think about and study, suggesting that vitamin D might prevent cancer, heart disease, diabetes, dementia, and so forth. So very similar to the kind of thinking we had about antioxidants, folic acid, omega-3s, estrogen, and other substances. So one might hypothesize, well, it could work, or it should work, or it might work, but people get ahead of themselves and start measuring it and acting on it. But it's worth noting that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is the not-for-profit, it's a federal government part of Health and Human Services agency with volunteer physicians and staff, volunteer physicians and paid staff that look at public health recommendations. These are the people who say how often you should have a mammogram and how often you should have a colonoscopy or a test for blood in the stool. And what they have concluded, and I'll show you it at, and again in a different format, that there's no role for screening for vitamin D deficiency in the United States. So the current recommendations are you don't need a regular blood test for vitamin D. In addition, the Institute of Medicine, who has been setting our vitamin requirements for decades, basically says that there's no evidence that supplemental vitamin D lowers the risk of non-skeletal health outcomes. So this means this sentence doesn't say anything about bone disease, which I'm coming to next. But in terms of non-bone disease, there's a pretty wide consensus that we're still hoping, that we don't know yet whether vitamin D is going to confer any benefit. And the current guidelines are don't measure it and don't take it. Now, the issue is, are you getting enough in your diet, number one? And number two, is there any special benefit on your bones if you take more? And the recommended levels of vitamin D are shown here. So 600 international units if you're under age 70 and 800 if you're over age 70. And this is equivalent to 3 or 4 servings a day of the product shown here. And I'll show you more detail on this in just a moment. So the idea is basically a way to assess whether you're taking enough vitamin D and calcium as well, as you'll see in a moment, is if you think to yourself, am I taking in a portion of one of these foodstuffs on average at most meals or one meal a day. So if you have breakfast cereal or yogurt for breakfast or cottage cheese for breakfast and a yogurt for lunch and some milk in your coffee throughout the day, then you're probably getting enough vitamin D and calcium. And that this approach is adequate for almost everyone, including people who live way in the north. Now, one of the reasons we got into trouble was that many clinical laboratories, including UCSF, said that anything less than 30 was a deficiency. And that meant that 66% of our patients at the point at which we changed this were deficient in vitamin D. Well, that doesn't make any sense. And so the Institute of Medicine looked at this and said, wait a minute, 30 is not the right number. 20 is the right number. And now we've finally changed it here, and our number is about 15% of patients who are seen have lower numbers of vitamin D. So it's a much different amount, and a true deficiency is much lower than that. So 20 is meant to be the starting point of when you're on the borderline. So that's helped a little bit by making sure that your doctor or a clinician is using the right cut point for vitamin D if they are measuring. Now, calcium and vitamin D go together. Vitamin D helps you absorb calcium. As you know, calcium is important for skeletal health. As far as we can tell, food here too is the preferred approach. And again, there's no routine recommendation for supplements. So the thinking here has been, if you're growing bone when you're a young girl or a teenage girl or a young adult woman until about age 30 when bone mass peaks, you would think that if you took in extra calcium, you'd end up with thicker bones. You would think that, or hope that, but that's not true. You need adequate amounts of calcium, but again, like everything else in nutrition, extra is not beneficial. And similarly, you would think that since people start losing bone, it's roughly in their 30s and 40s, and with an accelerated loss at the menopause and well into older age, you would think that if you gave extra calcium and vitamin D then, you could slow the rate of decline. Again, wonderful aspiration, not proven to be true. So at the current stage, unfortunately, extra calcium and vitamin D does not appear to improve bone health over and above what the recommended values are for preventing deficiency, nor does it prevent bone loss later in life. So the take-home point here is make sure you're eating enough. If you're not eating enough, systematically, say if you have lactose intolerant and can't eat a dairy product, then there is a role for low doses of supplements, but not for a routine tonic for everyone worried about good health. There have also been some studies about, you know, atherosclerosis, and when we say cardiovascular disease and talk about stroke and heart attacks, it's really hardening of the arteries is the disease. And hardening of the arteries means that calcium is now on the arteries. So you can think of it as you get older, you lose calcium from your bones and it ends up on your blood vessels, and that's what leads to a stroke and heart attack. That's sort of a joke, but that's basically what's happening. And so there have been some studies that at least raise the question about whether people who take extra calcium have more hardening of the arteries. So this may not be totally benign. So again, the take-home message is prevent deficiency, but don't take too much. And here are the doses of calcium. So it's 1,000 milligrams per day for younger folks and a little bit higher for the women over 50 and men over 70. And again, if you take too much, we believe that you may run into difficulties. So just for fun, here are some values of calcium in the diet. And again, these are foods that are also rich in vitamin D. So you can think about it either way. The foodstuffs are roughly the same. But again, you can see that if your goal is 1,200 milligrams per day, say, you know, it's not impossible to do this with diet. You know, so if you're eating a diet and paying attention to calcium intake, then this is achievable with real food. And so especially if you like dairy products, and because of the limit on saturated fats still, not an absolute limit, but a limitation of less than 10% of calories, so we will still use the phrase lower fat or low fat dairy products, you see you can get a ton of calcium from diet. Fruits and vegetables, especially green leafy vegetables, are relatively rich. And again, this is one case where portion size works to your advantage, because a salad of kale salad is might be 3 or 4 cups, or bok choy and so forth. Unfortunately, we don't eat as many canned fish with the bones as we used to, but that's another rich way to get dietary calcium. And then, of course, it is fortified in some grain-type products and breads and grains. So, you know, you can, unless you have a strict lactose intolerance and can't use dairy at all, it is quite feasible on a low-calorie, lower-fat diet to, with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and plant foods and the like, to get adequate calcium and vitamin D. And so this is what the Preventive Services Task Force says. It's a little bit confusing, but basically they say, we don't know for sure, and I means insufficient evidence. So if we look at all the studies, if we think that calcium and vitamin D should prevent fractures and bone loss, we just don't know if that's true at any age. So that's true for teenagers, young adults, or older adults. We don't know, and we think there may be some disadvantages and maybe some adverse effects that taking supplements of vitamin D or calcium are beneficial. So we do not routinely recommend that. I'm going to skip this one because it's confusing, but basically what they say is don't take lower amounts either. There's an insufficient evidence for screening for vitamin D, but if you are getting a blood test, make sure your lab is using 20 as the cut point and not 30. And there's some evidence that in people with a high risk of falls that vitamin D may be useful. So that's the one thing where vitamin D works. And the other place where it works is if you're taking a medicine already for bone disease. So if you're taking an osteoporosis medication, all of those medications were originally proven to be effective in patients who are also given calcium and vitamin D at the same time. So for established bone disease, you do need calcium and vitamin D, but otherwise, most people do not. So just to summarize the dietary supplement part of the story, beta-carotene is harmful despite our initial optimism. vitamin E and harmful folic acid, neutral, good to prevent neural tube defects. So women of reproductive age should have adequate dietary folate. Omega-3s, no benefit. And vitamin D and calcium used with bisphosphonates. And if you are truly deficient, then you need to correct that. So here are Michael Pollan's three rules. And, you know, it's pretty hard to beat these. So eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It's very similar to the rule I have about medical care in general, which is see doctors, not too much, mostly primary care. But in the context of nutrition, you know, this is hard to beat. You could probably add down here maybe and some fish. And based upon our current thinking, that would be a pretty sensible way to eat. And here are a few other things that I would add to that set of suggestions. We've talked a lot about eating unprocessed foods in the context of calories, sodium, sugar, refined products, and the like. So unprocessed foods, eat the right amount to maintain your body weight. It's very hard to lose weight, but the goal should be, as you age, don't gain any more weight. Eat something colorful at every meal. This was a Barron family rule, but we didn't count Skittles. This is the kind of thing where you don't ask a child or a kid, what kind of vegetables, do you want vegetables tonight? The conversation is, do you want broccoli or asparagus? Don't drink any calories. Now, this is a little hyperbolic. I've already mentioned that wine may be healthful, but it is caloric, so it's about the same amount of calories as a glass of Pepsi. So you want to make sure that as you're thinking about your calorie budget, that's part of the conversation. And then low-fat dairy products may also be an important part of your calcium and vitamin D source for some. This is probably more a life philosophy than a nutritional one, but if you can't make the best choice, make a better choice. That sometimes we find ourselves in environments where we don't control the food, so you have to make the best choice you can. We didn't talk fully about this tonight, but be as fit as you can be, exercise daily. This is the biblical idea, and eat at home, and for those of you who have kids, eat with kids. So it's sort of in this context that I've tried to bring people together, nutrition guru, if you will. I get very frustrated by these debates that have been going on for decades at the margins of what we think about nutrition. As I said, I would be suspicious about anyone who has a really strong feeling about this because there's probably a book to be sold or a product that goes with the book. And if you really dissect out what people are saying and pin them down, there are very few people who are suggesting you should have more sugar, more refined grains, more saturated fat, or any trans fat, right? No one is saying that, no matter what they're pushing. Almost everyone agrees you should eat fruits and vegetables. I mean, there are some people at the fringe of the spectrum that would argue that. But if they say don't eat fruit, at least they say eat vegetables. Again, most people will say healthy oils are on the good list. Again, people may argue about whole grains, but the majority opinion here is that if you're going to eat any carbohydrate, and the majority opinion is that you should, it should be lesser amounts and they should be whole. And that legumes and nuts, I've shown you some data to suggest those may be beneficial in and of themselves. So again, whether you're pushing vegetarian diets or focusing on sugar or paleo or low carb or whatever, I think we can all come in the middle here with these basic principles. And it's what I call when I am teaching the doctors to think about as a generic diet in the same way we use generic medications. So I've included in the slide set a bunch of resources for you, and I'll get these to you electronically for those who want them. And with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention. Botanically, I'm not sure I can fully answer that. There may be someone in the room who can, but legumes are beans and nuts. So I think they're seeds as part of the plant. Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Coffee doesn't, but other things do. Green leafy vegetables, for example, interfere with calcium. It helps some of the chemicals in plant products can bind dietary calcium, but probably not enough to worry about. So in other words, you'll remember that green leafy vegetables are a source of dietary calcium, so the absorption is less a percent of the amount that's in the food, but it's still adding to your dietary benefit. So coffee per se doesn't really interfere with hardly anything. It can stimulate a little bit of acid secretion, but for most people, not very much, and in moderation, has no nutritional impact. Yes?
How do you feel about peanut butter?
I feel fine about peanut butter. The question is, how do I feel about peanut butter? I don't really have feelings about peanut butter. If you mean, what do I think about peanut butter? I think peanut butter is potentially a very healthy food. It's high in calories, like many nut products are. And so you just need to figure out where you are in your calorie budget. Peanut oil is a little higher in fats, and it's a little less unsaturated and less monounsaturated than some of the other vegetable fats. But as in a calorie appropriate dose, it's a perfectly good foodstuff. And that would be true of the other nut butters.
I guess I would.
Yeah, so the question is why is our taste preference for sodium less permanent than our taste preference for sweets? And I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, one of the current hypotheses, based on some science done here, is that the sugars are more connected to some of the brain neurochemical systems in terms of satisfaction and endorphins and serotonin and so forth. You know, if you have read the books about sugar as an addictive substance, you know, that's sort of the logic of that. I don't think that that science is mature. I don't think that's proven. It certainly acts in many people as an addictive-like substance, and it can be shown in the laboratory to have some of those similar effects on the neurological system as other substances that make people high and addicted. So it's certainly a theory that's in play, and it has face validity in the sense that we do observe people who can't break the habit. Or think they can't. The truth is they can, in the same way that people can come off highly addictive substances. You know, people can stop heroin and stop oxycodone addiction, and people certainly can stop sugar addiction. But salt is an easier one. Now, I don't know why, because the old Sanskrit used to say there are six flavors, and of them all, salt is the greatest. But I think that the take-home point here is that that excess sodium is problematic. Severe restriction of sodium probably does not as beneficial as we once thought. And the main advantage of restricting salt is that it will get you out of the other foods that are bad for other reasons also. So the question is skim milk better, less good for men than whole milk? I am not familiar with that, and I couldn't imagine why that would be. Milk is a pretty healthy, if you can digest lactose, then milk is a potentially good food stuff. Skim milk is pretty tasteless. Whole milk has a few extra calories and a little bit of extra saturated fat. And I think if you find the magic middle there, you know, the Goldilocks milk, you're probably right, whether that's 1% or 2%. You probably don't need the extra butterfat in whole milk because you'd probably rather eat that as butter elsewhere later in the day. So I think 1% or 2% milk is probably the way to go. There's no benefit of skim milk for most people, though. The amount of saturated fat in 1% or 2% milk for the way most of us consume milk is trivial. And I'm not aware of any gender differences there.
Okay.
So the question was about, I thought the follow-up of the Marin breast cancer study, my understanding is the most recent publication about that showed that the rates have equalized, so that there's no longer an increased rate of breast cancer in general in women in Marin. So that observation has been neutralized. However, the relationship between alcohol, even in low doses in breast cancer, does not come just from the Marin data, but comes from a variety of studies in a variety of locations. So that, unfortunately, is a relationship that persists, that alcohol, women who use alcohol have a slightly increased, have an increased risk of breast cancer than women who are teetotalers. Now, the important thing for all these diseases, whenever you hear any of these studies and someone says, then such and so increases your risk of something happening, say by a quarter, your immediate response should say, it's a quarter higher than what? You know what I mean by that? So if your risk of breast cancer is relatively low because you don't have any other risk factors for breast cancer and you're being screened regularly, then increasing that by a quarter may not be that important to you, whereas your risk of cardiovascular disease may be much more, and if you lower that by a quarter, it has a much more impact. You follow? So the relative increase, the 20% increase or the 20% decrease, has to be utilized in the context of 20% of what? The 20% change in a small number is a small change. 20% change in a big number is a big change. And so although the risk, and this is all from observational data, but although the risk of breast cancer is greater with alcohol than without, the risk of cardiovascular disease is less. And since the leading cause of death in women is cardiovascular disease, the net effect is probably beneficial for both men and women. Does that make sense? No. So the question was, what about where are we at with food politics? And in essence, what you're asking is, you know, what impact does the food industry have on our nutritional health? And, you know, the short answer is not good. And it's analogous, I think, to many other major political issues. You could have exchanged nutrition in that paragraph for your favorite, whether, you know, it's Wall Street or big banks or military-industrial complex or, you know, wars we shouldn't be fighting or, you know, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, we all have our own list of issues. And certainly there's a relationship between the food industry analogous to, say, the oil industry or the energy industry in terms of influencing the choices we made, no question about it. You know, so some people have estimated, Mary Nestle in particular, that the per capita amount of calories available to us as a society are 3,500 calories per day. Now, most of us need, and by most of us, we use 2,000 calories a day, but that's too much for many of the people in the room. So I made reference to 2,000 because it's easy for the arithmetic, but most of us probably need 1,800 or 1,600. And women who are smaller and have are shorter, have less muscle mass, may need as few as 1,500 or 1,400. So, and if 3,500 calories is around us, that's there to sell. And that's the only reason it's there. And it's, I think it's analogous to why we drive big cars and not use public transportation. But it, there's no question about it, or the whole story of cigarettes. Why did people start smoking? Or so it's on that list. There's no question about it. And I think whatever your political strategy is, you'll have to apply it to this problem too. But it's not unique, but it's not easy. Yeah, so the question is, what about probiotics? Where to begin? And the answer is, I'm not going to end on that because it's way too big a conversation. But I think we're still learning about probiotics. So we are thinking about that in medicine. There are a few illnesses for which there's some early clinical trials that probiotics may be beneficial. Whether one needs to go out of their way to take probiotics every time one takes a short course of antibiotics, probably not. But we don't know that yet. So my own preference remains to eat plant foods and to not take antibiotics except when you really need them. That's probably more important a decision than what you do when you take them unnecessarily. So save the antibiotics. Don't eat meat products with antibiotics that have been used to raise the meat products. Don't take antibiotics for viral infections, bronchitis, and other things you don't need antibiotics for. Probiotics at this point seem harmless, but unproven for most conditions. But again, there's a short list where it is probably coming into play. I want to end with coming back to your point. One thing I meant to say, because I often mention this to the physicians, and I would say it, I don't know if any of you are physicians or other health professionals or health workers, but one of the local politics that one can do is model what we're discussing, so that if you're working with patients or want to influence children or communities or whatever, the most important thing we can do is to model the behaviors. So I think that one of the factors that I think was most important, the sort of the tipping point of when doctors were able to get patients to quit smoking, was when doctors stopped smoking. And so again, if doctors or the rest of us are comfortable eating this way and exercising this way, then that allows us with greater confidence and authority to counsel others and advocate for those kind of issues. So it is an uphill battle, but there's plenty of steps that we as individuals and groups of people can take. Thank you all very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.